Healing prayer. That is for physical healing, emotional healing, spiritual healing. If you would like to take advantage of that, you need to call the office. You need to have an appointment. You can come during that time, 7:30, and you can have a sign up for a half-hour appointment with two people who have been trained to help pray for people. You can also, if you want to come and just sit here, which we had actually our largest number of people last month do that, you can take advantage of this place, this atmosphere, a time that has been anointed for prayer. You can sit and seek the Lord on your own if you do not want a prayer appointment. And then the whole time is closed with communion. And I think a number of people have found that very meaningful. So if there's something you want to work through with the Lord, please, and even if you're going to do that, if you're going to sit, we would like to know that you're going to come. So we'd like you to call the office and talk to Deborah and confirm that. Also, next weekend, The Amazing Grace, the movie. Has anybody seen it yet? I'm wondering. Okay, a number of hands. How was it? Recommended. All right. There is a time for people who want to discuss that movie. It's going to be on Saturday at 4:30, I think is when it is. It's in the bulletin. So that's on Saturday afternoon. That'll meet right before the night of prayer, which will run from 6 to 12. As always, everyone is invited to be a part of that night of prayer. If you can make it for the whole time, great. But if you only can make it for an hour or 2 hours or 3 hours, we welcome you and actually encourage you to be there. We want to gather as a body and pray. There's a booklet that Stuart talked about called Seek God for the City 2007. They put this out, I'm not sure when they started, but they put it out each year. It's 40 days of praying for the city. It's designed to be the 40 days before Palm Sunday, but it's actually a resource you could use anytime. And each day has a specific thing to pray for the city, and it's packed with scriptures. These are available. There's a box up here in the front row. We're asking for a $2 donation for them. That's how much they cost. So it's for you to come. Throw $2 in the box, take one. That's how we're going to work this. I would also like to invite the ushers this time if they would come forth and receive the tithe and offerings.
Morning. I really encourage you to take advantage of that our monthly night of healing prayer. Especially, you know, the moments when the Lord is working in your life and when the dealings of God, even sometimes it's just great at the month to get that time, if you've even been to the altar rail, and just to get some extended time. Sometimes there are just some even limitations, even when we gather on a Sunday. I was just so encouraged by some of the testimonies from last month's meeting of those who just came and sat in the presence of the Lord. Sometimes you don't need to speak to anybody. You know why? Because it's such a long time since we spoke to God. And it's probably actually a good rule of counseling to encourage people to spend an hour at least talking with the Lord before they talk to somebody else about it. It's not that it's an either or, it is a both and. The Lord uses both. But I encourage you to do that and take communion afterwards. I'm going to share something with you that I haven't shared in public before. It's a story that is rarely shared. I have received permission to do so this morning. I first really met Josh. I'd been aware of him over 25 years ago now in San Jose, where Celia and I had moved from the United Kingdom. It was a very hard first 6 months for us when we came to this country to acclimate, harder than we could ever have expected. And we were at a point in our life where we were really needing to find some rootedness and some solidity. Josh was one of the pillars that God brought into our lives who helped connect us with sanity, frankly, and sanctity. A feeling of rock amidst what felt at the time for us like an awful lot of sand dunes. Josh was several years older than me, but the difference in years was no barrier to an immediate affinity and friendship. You know, all of you, how that goes. I'm not actually going to mention his full name this morning. Soon you will know who he is, or you'll be, I think, likely to hear about him if your ear is bent to national voices that are going to be currently speaking to the soul of the nation. Many of us are hoping that God will release this man in the national context, even to the upcoming 2008 election. There are many, way more discerning than I, who believe that the ministry that God has given him is supremely timely for our land. Josh was a pastor in Northern California at the time that I first met him, very attractive man, strong, forthright in his communications, remarkably mellow, humble would be a better word, sort of weathered in a way, but not worn. There was a spirit of brokenness about him, without him sort of really being bent out of shape. I don't know about you, but you know, there are times when you meet some people whose eyes are so clear that they emanate almost a sense of purity. That struck me when I first met Josh. He had such eyes, the sort of eyes that look right through you. I've known people like that in my life, both men and women. Unfortunately for me, my father was one of them. So I gave up at an early age of thinking I could get by with anything. You know, it's also tough having parents who operate in the word of knowledge. Another that I remember as a young man was Duncan Campbell. Some of you who've read his story, the man God used in the tremendous revival of the Hebrides. I mean, you sort of, there are these people that you sort of get your life sorted out and you get all cleaned up and fessed up before you even meet them. Josh had those kind of eyes. But fortunately, as I've said, they were also kind eyes. We had some common concerns in ministry. I was in the Silicon Valley, living and serving the Lord, and these common concerns brought us together. There were a lot of things stirring in California, spiritually in the early 80s. There was a precious move of the Holy Spirit, especially amongst Catholics, who were getting saved and filled with the Spirit by the droves, maybe I should say by the masses. When I learned Josh's story, I more than realized why he radiated such grace and stability and why there was such a princely air of assurance about him. The brief version is this. He was 20 years old when he was about to participate in his first Youth with a Mission outreach. How many of you have ever been related to Youth with a Mission apart from me? How many have been on either a DTS or a, man, that must be the lowest number we've had in church for a long time. But Youth with a Mission, how many have heard of Youth with a Mission? Lauren, yeah, tremendous. What an honor to God that we've all heard of it. It was in the city of San Francisco that he was going, near the infamous Tenderloin District. It was actually, as he described it, going to be his ministry debut. It was his first foray into mission. And at that time, he had a deep passion for God and for his word. It combined with a sensitive heart for God. And like probably some of you, and certainly as I did years ago, he chose Youth with the Mission precisely because its emphasis was so much on knowing the character and the ways of God. He'd done his discipleship training school. I can't remember where. Maybe it was the Chico base. It was open then. And he was consciously preparing for the upcoming mission and getting excited about what God was going to do and show him about his future life and ministry. He'd already had an invitation to do a year's pastoral internship in a church in Sacramento. He thought he might do some seminary training after that. It was after his team's first day in the red light district that God spoke clearly to him that he was going to get married because, among other things, he was going to need a partner in the ministry that he was being called to. That excited him. He always wanted to be a husband and hopefully a dad, and he was pretty happy about that confirmation. He said that he'd already prepared himself to accept singleness if the nature of his calling demanded it, though he couldn't think of specific reasons at the time why that would be so. But as he tells his story, it was the next thought that went through his mind that completely shattered his understanding of what hearing God was all about, of God's will, of moral principle, and of Christian marriage, and of just about everything he thought he believed. Josh hesitated at this point of his story, as he probably did with everyone else that he got to tell it to, and it wasn't many. No doubt bracing himself for the reaction that his next words were going to solicit from me. Immediately into his mind, he describes, came a strong, clear visual of a young hooker. The last one that he'd spoken to that day, who, as it turned out, had been inquisitively and poignantly more open than the others, much to his relief. Maybe she just hadn't been trawling as long as the others. He couldn't quite work out her age. The wear and tear of prostitution ages young women quickly, as you know, and it's hard to read through the hard lines of their faces to truly discern the real contours of their life and their story and their feelings. His first reaction was to really worry that something very unsavory and unclean had velcroed to his spirit, that something visually bad and tempting was invading his thought life, and he'd better not expose himself any further to it. In fact, maybe just get off the team. But no sooner did he think that than he knew that that wasn't actually so, that wasn't true. And extraordinary as it sounds, without a second's delay, he realized, he believed, that God was calling him to marry her and get her off the streets. I should point out to you that Josh was well thought of by everyone who knew him. He had an outstanding testimony as a young man. He was known as zealous and righteous in his walk with the Lord. He was a leader in his youth group. And he came from a really solid Christian family. And it didn't take him long to work out that clearly no one would understand this, and everyone would think he'd flipped, or worse still, that he'd reneged on his faith by committing some immoral act with this hooker, whose name was, as it happens, Bernie. And this was the way of making a really bad spiritual recovery for a really bad sinful fumble. It was crazy. This wasn't his imagined picture of a fine young Christian woman prepared to join him in a life work for God. So what to do? And I'm sure you'd give him the same counsel I would. Wisdom and sense would tell him to talk to someone, his team leader, YWAM base leader, parents, youth pastor, the Pope, somebody. But again, he describes how he knew the answer he'd get. And he also knew that any conversation would raise so many questions and foster so much potential trust that he was shot if he didn't, shot if he didn't. It sort of crossed his mind rather fearfully that he was possibly going to do something the next day that would be an unhelpful precedent for the work of Youth of the Mission. He felt strangely numb. He was honest about admitting that even to this day he has no idea why normal, reasonable mental halt signs didn't jam his brain. He'd listened to all those Joy Dawson tapes that many of us have been nurtured on about hearing the voice of God. So how could this be God? Looking back now, he can almost joke about it. A holy life with a hooker wife. It sounded like a sort of bizarre Christian book title. Surely, if ever there was a time in life to put out proverbial fleeces, this was it. Maybe something really obvious, like, you know, if San Francisco and the entire Tenderloin district disappears in an earthquake tonight, then I will do it. Of course, you laugh because he could joke about it too. It would certainly do it because it would have taken care of him as well as Bernie. But to cut a long story short, though in time terms it wasn't actually long, because it was only 24 hours later, after outreach team hours, that he amazingly found her working the same part of the street on which he'd spoken to her. And in answer to her commercial question, as he approached her, he asked her if she would marry him. It was an absolutely crazy, out-of-this-world guts obedience. So he didn't think there'd be any response but some incredulous, mocking laughter. He described his utter shock at the quietness that pervaded her replying acceptance absolutely wiped him off his feet. Because the best that he'd hoped was that this was some one of those kind tests that people talk about, some kind weird divine obedience test that would turn out to have no relationship with reality. Now it had. He had no idea what to do. He'd never even dated. His first touch of a woman was taking this hooker's hand and starting to walk down the street he didn't know where, hoping that no other YWAMers were led by God to do some late night witnessing, and hoping the ground would open up and this would all prove to be a bad dream or an explainable reaction to an early childhood drug. The time allowed me this morning is sadly too short. It always is. For you. For me, to really do justice to Joshua's story and also to try and teach something, I wish I could. The extraordinary way that they got to solemnize their vows, as you can only guess, the extremely awkward first few days of their relationship. But also the reactions, the disavowals, the distancing, the accusations, the shock, the pain, the disbelief, the abandonment, the gossip, the betrayals. You can imagine some of the stuff without me suggesting it, and you could name it yourselves. I don't sadly have time to tell you how he got a place to stay, how he got to provide for himself and for Bernie, after the church in Sacramento, not surprisingly, decided that their relationship and the mechanics of their story was not the kind of example they wanted from a member of pastoral staff. How he navigated the immediate fears of health issues, of the specter of AIDS, no less. Was this life God was giving him, or lurking living death? Or how she got clean? As things turned out, God was good, and she was graced. Suffice it to say that life held tentatively together, but it did hold. The strongest thing going for him at that time was his feeling that he was called to that part of California. No disrespect to the Californians here. It was my wonderful place of entry into this nation, and I love her for that. But he was called to that part of California with all its sinful extremisms and weirdness, its wealth and its wine, its immigrant poor, its demonic cults, its deviant sexuality, and it's just its godless, decent people. It seemed that Bernie understood the claims of Christ on her life. It was as unbelievable a train of events for her as for him, if you think about it. And it seemed, but not to many, or maybe any apart from themselves, that God was doing something slightly out of the ordinary, something strange and wonderful through this every which way unlikely pairing. Though their isolation and loneliness was a tremendous burden. In retrospect, maybe some of that was self-imposed. It wasn't long after the birth of their first son, about a year later, that Josh noticed that Bernie was getting a little listless, and he put it down to all the postpartum stuff that he'd heard about, didn't know much about it. And he encouraged her to engage other things and new interests because, although she'd in fact never completed high school, she was blessed with a prescient intelligence and so much creativity. I wish you could see, for example, her interior house designs, absolutely incredible, with the furniture designs that went with every room. She enrolled in some evening classes in a nearby Christian college that had designed a special further education curriculum as an outreach and service to the community. Initially, she did it to get some administrative skills. They thought this might be helpful if they ever planted a church sometime. That seemed the only way that they were ever going to get to pastor. Josh was more than happy to take on some more Mr. Mom roles, and they worked the schedule to make things happen for her. She used to come back from night classes tired, probably because it was so late, too late, he realized, to be good for her. And their plans took a change when she found out she was pregnant. It was a strangely joyless pregnancy, as Josh describes it. And he began to feel the strains for the first time, especially as she continued to seem depressed and distant after their daughter was born. He started to get really frightened by just the way he found it so difficult to even begin to relate to her or even his own child, as if he'd caught this disease of distance from her. He started to question his assurances. And when she insisted 3 months after the birth that she's preparing to go back to school and wanted to go and do evening classes now in interior decorating, he decided to go along with it, despite the irregularities of their life. things did not get better. No sooner had she weaned their daughter than she was pregnant again. And by this time, Josh was beginning to wonder, as he describes it, what was earth was happening to them. It felt like judgment. Didn't feel like grace. He described time as passing very slowly, and his hopes of ever serving the Lord again continued to plummet, a bit like the crashing Dow index. He actually felt he was just destined to become part of the statistics of American dysfunctional families. At the deepest level, he said he knew God was true, but the fact that nothing about his life, especially his present relationship with Bernie, was either squaring up with a sense of his call, or particularly with that original word that God appeared to give him to marry her, well, all of that took him to the very brink of faith. He was left with truth by the fingernails, as he described it, little feeling and emotionally worn down. And as you can guess, there really wasn't much joy. The possible effects on the little ones, young as they were, convinced him that they'd lost the chance, or would lose the chance, of ever being a reasonably functional pastoral family. If he ever got the chance, his family would disqualify itself. And so it was that the repeated misery and listlessness following their son's birth convinced him that it was maybe time to face reality, ask Bernie to see a counselor or someone who might be able to discern what was going on. He began to think that her desire to do interior decorating was some sort of symbolic cry for what she needed in the interiors of her own heart and mind. He couldn't work it out. She didn't disclose much. It was a great surprise to him that she agreed to go. At the appointed day and time, she went, and that was the last time that Josh ever saw her. He was 25, a suddenly single dad, three little ones, and he really wasn't sure if he ever wanted to hear God's voice again. Would you blame him? You'd probably have been with me among those who said he checked out. He'd already walked, I think you'll guess by now, an exacting path before very disbelieving and incredulous Christian spectators, bearing in his own soul deep and sometimes irrational feelings of shame and worthlessness. And now it was just ratcheted up a whole lot more, and I have frankly no idea how he did it. The I told you so's were as comforting as it was going to get for him. His neighbors knew he was a Christian. His fellow workers knew he wanted to really be a pastor. So how would he explain all this? What on earth would he ever have to say from a platform like this that was crumbling around his feet? And time passed. 3 years exactly, as he describes it. His worst fears had long since been realized. He was not the father of his second child, and needless to say, he guessed pretty quickly that the third was not his either. But they were hers, and therefore theirs, and he decided therefore his. By observation, the last two kids, from the day they were born, never looked related. Over and above and underneath all this was the gnawing sadness for Josh, a feeling that he was forever destined to never be a pastor, whose preaching and teaching would be taken seriously. And it dripped like acid on his soul. He loved the Word of God, and he longed to teach it. And it was only by sheer dogged obedience, fueled by clearly immeasurable grace, that he'd been able to stay digging in Scripture during this time, quietly and secretly writing scratchy sermons that he would never preach. He needed strong meat, so he describes how he took solace most of the time in the Old Testament. Josh explained that this was because he was struggling to believe that he was still a candidate for more grace, or sufficient grace. Pronouncements of judgment seemed to fit his circumstances better. Weren't very encouraging, but at least he knew where he stood. He'd had to feed himself, so his messages had an audience of one. And the context of the times didn't help. For those of you who remember the 80s, how many remember the 80s? Terrible admission. Okay. You remember the 80s. some memories may come back even as I say this. You see, the context of those times didn't help him. He didn't want to hear another word about Reaganomics as he observed the social injustices among the poor of his city, the so-called capital of his state. Despite the desirability and predicted prospects of Glasnost and a certain Mr. Gorbachev, he didn't really want to hear another thing about his own nation's positional sense of power and influence in the world when she was so immoral and hypocritical at home. He certainly didn't want to read another scandalous story about yet another fallen Christian charismatic leader. And he definitely didn't want to receive another invitation to a happy clappy conference. He didn't want to answer his phone. But about this time, one day he did. And he heard something that he'd half waited and half feared for a long time, as life suddenly in a moment went full circle. It was a Christian ministry, God bless them, in San Francisco, some extraordinary ministries in San Francisco. The cities of our nation are hard places to plant churches, guys, in our day. They spit out churches. It's like the powers that be will allow certain things or seed certain growth and all hell breaks loose. I don't like it. San Francisco is such a place, but there's some extraordinary pure works in that city. Some of you may well know them. I'm thinking of a particular Presbyterian church that has been an absolute lighthouse in that city, multiracial, multi-gifted in God communication and congregation. But this is one of these Christian ministries, worked in the red light district in San Fran, and they had come across Bernie in the course of their ministry in a really bad state. And they'd tracked Josh down. They pieced some of her story together. Soon after beginning night school, as you probably guessed, she began having an affair with another student, professing Christian. And the daughter was surely his. And when she returned to school, it was yet another dalliance, professing Christian. On disappearing, that she had moved to Los Angeles with him. She went and the relationship broke up apparently after 6 months. She ended up in the place she knew best, vulnerable and poor, pimped, and inevitably indebted, and basically no different from a sex trafficked woman. Let me ask you this. I don't know if in your life you've had the privilege of meeting some heroes and heroines of faith. You know, the kind of people when you meet them and hear their story, you're in absolute awe of their walk with God, what they've endured, and how they have still triumphed in suffering. Some of you have heard Sharon Cohn, tell of such a one, Elizabeth, that young Christian girl sold into a brothel by a relative, rescued by the power of God through the mission of International Justice Mission, now in college. Elizabeth comes to mind just because of the context connection. You know how it is, you believe, you sort of know when you hear these stories that you yourself have never really been tested. And you're not even sure when you have that thought at first if you actually would ever pass the test if it was given to you. Obviously, I feel that way about Josh. Maybe Sharon feels that way about Elizabeth. I always will feel that way about Josh. Please forgive me. I need to get to the text of my message. I apologize for the time I'm taking on this. But there was an extraordinary ending to Josh's story that pushed the envelope even further than it had been pushed when he first met Bernie and led her off the streets. Through an incredible train of circumstances, again, I haven't got time, but just suffice it to say, it was orchestrated by God. Josh was able to work a deal with a pimp. He sort of half amusingly describes how he never thought he'd feel like another pimp trading for a hooker, for his own stable. Nothing in his life or in his discipleship training class prepared him for that. Those who deal with prostitution and sex trafficking, like, for example, Sharon and others, will tell you that it's not cheap when the pimp computes his loss of earnings. And it in fact took everything that Josh had. And I guess everything is enough. He liquidated everything, including his granddad's gold signet ring, which he talks about winsomely. It was the only possession, in fact, that he had that was of emotional worth to him. I have my father's. Some of you may have a grandfather's or a grandmother's ring, and you know something of the meaning, the generational meaning that gets attached to that. I should mention that it was the last thing to go, only because his grandfather had been a godly and much-loved pastor who had prayed over Josh when he was young for a double portion of his mantle to be on his grandson. Josh's voice, remarkably measured, broke at this point in the story. I'll never forget it. As he explained that the ring was for him a symbol of that mantle, the only connection that he had to his granddad, and that word, that promise, he could feel it. With the rest of his feelings numb, he could at least feel that. And it helped him believe the promise and the call that he felt he'd got from God were tangible, would come true. Just given the integrity of his holy granddad, surely it would come through. But when? I'm sure I've already shared enough for you to realize that if Josh wrote his full story, it would be a bestseller. For obvious reasons, he will not do so for a public that would only, including a Christian public, that would only sensationalize it. There are a few of us who have heard some parts, and more parts than I'm sharing of it firsthand, from either Josh or Bernie, but definitely I haven't heard all of it. So it's a special and rare dispensation I've been granted for me to tell it today. Clearly not as well as he would do if he was here in person. He paid the pimp, drove Bernie, passively reluctant but evidently relieved, back to Sacramento. And directed by what he felt the Lord showed him to do, they embarked on a very ordered, very disciplined, very structured process of healing. Spiritual healing, lots of physical healing and treatment, lots of necessary deliverance and heart cleansing for both of them. And of course, that refamiliarization as a family and the process, as you can only guess, of reconnecting with the kids and facing the consequences of the past in their faces had its own challenges and pains that required all of their unity and all of their faith. But, you know, as we've seen in so many passages of Scripture, but God. Amidst the tenderness and rawness of it all, God provided, and as he loves to do, as Jehovah Jireh, provisions, some very significant, came from unknown sources, unrelated sources. They had no marital relations for a long time, until in fact they ended an agreed period of re-engagement. He bought her a small ruby ring this time, and she bought him, guess what? You guessed it. A gold signet ring. He took it off his finger once, and almost shyly, certainly trustingly, showed the inscription on the inside that Bernie had chosen. No one, not you, not me, would ever have guessed a word of it in a million years. It took up the whole interior space of the band in very, very precisely but clearly readable etched letters, and it just said, "You are my green tree." He looked sort of slightly pleased at my nonplussed look, promised to explain it to me at a later time, which in fact he did. You're probably itching yourself to know the story behind that that will reveal its meaning. But again, sadly, I just don't have time unless of course you give me a moment when I'm through at the end to do so. It's your call. How tantalizing. Does that need a constitutional vote? I should mention, by the way, that I heard the tape recording, went quite into MP3s then, of the worship at their service, of the renewal of their vows. I've got to tell you, I have rarely in my life, I've been to some amazing places and amazing events, but I have rarely in my life heard free worship like it. It wasn't because there were hundreds of people there. It was this, I don't know how many of you love antiphonal, but it was like this antiphonal layering of one voice on another, calling to another. it really, as you listen to it, if you shut your eyes, it made you think, this is what angelic choirs sound like. It reminded me of some music I used to listen to as a student, trying to get to sleep, the Tudor music of Tallis. For those of you who know that incredible work based on Lamentations, Speminalium, absolutely extraordinary, always what I thought heaven sounded like. I've also seen the photos of their service, and I've got to tell you, it was a picture of heaven. I mean, just looking at them, you could feel the sanctity and the holiness as an awesome thing. Because what a story it told. The picture of what God had done just bladed your heart if you looked at it. When I first saw those photos, I couldn't help but think immediately of the description in, you know, in Revelation of the marriage supper of the Lamb, the church, despite all her past unfaithfulness, the constant faithlessness, the faithlessness of her members, yet all on the arm of Jesus. I must confess, it was one of those days, you know, we say that we don't hunger for heaven and that we're so this worldly minded. But it was one of those days that I never wanted that future day to be so much a present one. And when I shared that with Josh, he sort of said it was interesting, but that was almost the universal response from all who saw them. It seemed to be what the Holy Spirit did. It's how the Holy Spirit interpreted those photos and that tape to most viewers and listeners. Of course, needless to say, lest you think it's a sentimental moment, great conviction also gripped my soul, accompanied by that thought, and a great desire to live a consecrated and a faithful life now in order to be ready for that altar then. I can only say with others who know Josh, thank goodness a Christian magazine or publisher or Christian TV station did get their hands on him. Look, it's not that Josh hasn't got something to say or that he hasn't written anything. In fact, he has. But he's been patiently awaiting the release of what God has given him for the Kairos moment for our generation. I personally think it's drawing nearer by the day. I've been privileged to read his manuscript, and it is shocking in its weightiness and its power. I wish I could read it to you, or better still, preach it. It's one of the most relevantly prophetic things I've ever read in recent times, for both the present church and the present state of our land. And I will tell you when it's available. You'll be among the first to know. Don't expect signed copies. You've probably gathered by now that Josh is not into that sort of thing. And by the way, don't expect to satisfy your prurient curiosity about the details of their marriage or all that happened or even what happened to the kids. He very wisely has covered them. But also because inevitably, given what he has gone through, he only has time to speak about God and for God, especially about how God is persistent and pursuant long after we have all slept with some of God's enemies. I've got to tell you that just being around Josh, certainly reading his manuscript and listening to his messages, which are available if you know where to get them, makes me long for more intimacy with God. But it also makes me believe that God can supply my lack and supply me with what I need in order to love him truly and faithfully, which is where many of us stumble. As much as anyone in my life and circle of friends and mentors, he's given me an insight into the heart of God. He was jilted, but remained just. Humiliated, but remained humble. Shamed, but remained sure of the love and grace of God. Are you surprised that such a man, or that God can trust such a man? When it comes to how God feels about a nation like ours that is so badly squandered, its calling and blessing so stubbornly refused to own up to its national sins, or that in the words of Scripture has simply forgotten the rock from which it was hewn, that has worn God's name with an easy familiarity on its money of all things. He knew what the pain of separation felt like, what you go through when someone you love prostitutes themselves for the cheap and the tawdry, or worse, uses what you have given them to enrich your relationship, to actually spend on paramours, be they national gods and idols, or disastrous foreign alliances, or very personal and private pursuits. I don't think you are surprised that he and Bernie can speak with incredible authority about the power of God to transform the worst of personal situations, the worst of marriages, the worst of decisions, and the worst of consequences. Of course you're not. Very much hoping the day will come soon when Josh and Bernie can minister among us here. They're not actually invited much into churches because they're little known, but their story, mark my words, will be known. And hopefully they'll be able to share a fuller version. Let me just conclude their story by saying this. You may well ask, as we all do in these circumstances, as I have done of him, how on earth could you do what you did? Where'd you get the strength? Where'd you get the faith? Where did you get the trust? Where the courage? How did you overcome the pain and the grief and the loss? How did you live with being cuckolded? How did you cope with the reality that the destiny you'd longed for and always assumed had perished? How did you survive just having to deal with the thoughts of what your wife had been doing and was doing? How did you ever get the motivation or the compassion to take her back? How did he ever deal with the real possibility, based on past long performance, that it would or could in fact happen again? And I think you know exactly how these kind of questions tumble out. His face was always solemn when these questions arose, but not really troubled. But it was consistent for him to weep. He didn't weep most of the time when he told this extraordinary story. It always amazed me as a sign of the security God had brought him into. Now, you'll have to forgive me. Obviously, I can't remember the verbatim reply that he gave word for word, but I can remember the gist of it. And if I can sort of paraphrase his story and his communication, his response to all these questions that we would naturally ask, but what he said went something like this: it's easy to judge because there are clear reasons. There are irrefutable grounds for judgment. The consequences of sin and sin's wages are indisputably both clear and cruel. I have found in my own life, he would say, that it is God's compassion for me that against the odds and the facts insists on desiring me, seeking me, finding me, and forgiving me, a compassion that has no reasons that I can fathom. So he would say to our questions, I can give you no reason. No answers to your questions. I can only tell you something that is unreasonable, given the facts, but true. Bernie has always been my one and only wife of choice. I chose my love, and I love my choice. I could have walked, but I decided that a broken covenant was still better than no covenant, because it gave me the hope for its repair. And in fact, believe it or not, it aroused a longing for its renewal better than I could ever have imagined. You remember that I said to myself that I never wanted to hear the Lord's voice again, but I did. It wasn't that he spoke a lot, Josh would say, but I mean, it had a lot of content. It was actually a little. But it was the same thing repeated day after day, week after week, month after month. God said to me, love your wife again, though she has been loved by another, though she has given herself to another. Love her as the Lord loves you. So I did. And he still does. How do I know that? Because Bernie's told me so.
Witness and some of those other cults in society, people who join those, many times those are people who just come to faith. Just come to faith. It's very important. It's very important that people is discipled once they come to faith. That is so very crucial in our society. Well, she began to raise a religious issue to him, but the truth, and let me bring the truth home and we'll be through with this. She came to know Jesus. She left her water pot. She went into the city and she began to tell the people, come see a person who told me everything I've done. You see, real community development is raising up from that community indigenous leaders, mobilizing people with the problem to take responsibility for the village. And this woman takes responsibility for the village. She go back into the village and she bring the village out to meet Jesus. And so this felt need concept works, and it worked. And that became our, how do you implement that as I finish? I use something I call the 3 R of Christian community development. Bob was saying something about the first R tonight. I could see in Mendenhall, if we were going to be effective in this little community, that we had to get the young folks to go off to school and to come back to live in that village. That was our goal. That was our goal. And that was my goal. When I was in Mendenhall, people always look at Mendenhall and they see all the other things. I see just a little happen in Mendenhall. What I saw happen in Mendenhall was Dolphus came to Christ, his wife Rosa came to Christ, Otis came to Christ, Otis's wife came to Christ, and a few of the other young folks went off to college, got skills, and they came back to that community to live. They got a concern for that neighborhood. And after 12 years, we could leave there. We went to Jackson. And in Jackson, we stayed there for 10 years. Young people came to Christ, and they lived in that community. My own son and daughters lived in that neighborhood. And then after 12 years, we could leave and go to California. And we've been out there now for 11 years. Live in that village. And young folks there is coming to Christ, and we about finished in that neighborhood. In that neighborhood. And the idea is to get people to relocate and make the community livable. We got to recreate community again. The church in the New Testament is a church at a place. It's a church in a community. It is Jesus living in the midst. The early church was a parish. The early church people looked at it as a parish. And they were concerned about loving their neighbors as they love themselves. Today, people commute for 25 miles to come to get their needs met. And they're unconcerned about the neighbors. And the highest call of God upon our life is to love our neighbors as we love ourselves. And so the problem in my society today is both theologically, but it's also how we view the church. How we view the church. We don't see the church as being a community environment. We don't see our witness to the neighborhood as being our major witness of the church. And we will not solve the urban community problem until the church become the church. And I know in South Central LA, I'm working with 8 churches down there, putting them together into a, trying to develop youth division. Of those 8 churches, only one of them have a part-time youth worker in the community. And the biggest problem down there is gang. But you know what I have discovered since I've been working down there? Is that when you think of South Central Los Angeles, you used to think of 2 million black people living down there. Now that community is about 30% black and about 70% Spanish. The people who occupy those churches and those 30% that are there are these welfare mothers and gang fans who live in those apartments who are renting down there. and the black people who occupy those traditional churches live somewhere else. And they motor in there on a Sunday morning, put guards on the parking lot, protect their cars, and go in there and worship, and then go back out and then speak for those people down there and say, the government ought to do this. Somebody ought to be doing this for these people, for these poor people. They can't do nothing for themselves. They don't live there. They don't live there. And their faith is not relevant to the people and to that neighborhood and to that community. That is just a building. It has little to do with, and it's convincing the young folks in the community. It convincing them. And boys in the hood, they were laughing at those big churches in South Central Los Angeles. They were laughing at them. They call them Disneyland. They saw those churches as unrelated to their problem in the community. Because those churches are not there engaged. The people in those congregations are not engaged with the people in that neighborhood. So the first thing we got to do is get people to relocate. If we're going to be effective, we got to look at a church becoming a church in an 8-10 block, no more than 1 mile area. And to get their members to move back in and to live among the people and become one with the people. That's going to be the only way we're going to make impact. Otherwise, when we wake up, the Muslims are going to have it. We're going to wake up one of these days, and this territory is going to belong. You see, the gang have tried to do that already themselves. This graffiti and stuff is a code for who controls this neighborhood. People are crying out for help. This graffiti and stuff, that's crying out for help. And what our leaders say, what they need is, our black leaders say, what they need is role models. They need role models. So let's send them Magic Johnson. Well, Magic Johnson can't play safe sex himself. How do you expect the kids to play it? Let's send them Mike, what's his name? Michael Jackson. Let's send them those people down there. I'm saying what we need is a church to be there. We need the people of God there. We need people there with moral character and integrity living in the community. That's the need that we have. And the church is not about that. The church is about something else. I try my best to figure out as I go around, what is this about? What is this about? I mean, people need this. Second hour is reconciliation. Reconciliation. That's the purpose of the gospel. That's what the gospel is all about. It's to reconcile black and white, Jew and Gentile together. We all need this. But reconciliation needs to be the light that people see. That need to see that God is dealing with my racism and God is dealing with my bigotry. Because he's causing me to love people who are different from me. And my life is being enriched. So reconciliation. The third R is what I call redistribution. And redistribution is helping young folks to get the skills, the education, the motivation that is necessary so that those young folks can become producers and providers within the neighborhood. And if that don't happen, that's going to hasten the violence in the community. Young folks are selling drugs today. They're doing that as a business. As a business. And basically, most of the businesses that black folks own in the urban community now is the drug distribution center. The new Asian people are coming in and they're providing the goods and the service in the neighborhood. And so we've got to raise up a generation of young folks. We got to provide education that leads to creative, productive work. And we got to see work. Work is a divine virtue. Work is not a part of the curse. Work was before the curse because work expresses our creativity. Work reflects our image, which is the image of God. And that we can do more than work for ourselves. The admonishment in the Bible is Paul says to teach them to work with their own hand, not just for themselves, so they can have to give to other folks in need. You can do more than survive in our society. Well, those are the virtues. That's what community development is all about, and that's what I'm committed to. Well, I've gone a whole hour. That 30 minutes stretched into an hour. Good. Well, I'm finished. Maybe we should have some question and answer. Maybe we should have questions. Anything you misunderstood with my southern accent, you might have missed something. You got your chance, yeah.
What are some of the consequences you see coming from welfare reform that you talked about?
What kind of, the consequences I see. I see the possibility of real violence if you get some good leader. I think of, you get some person like Farrakhan to tell people what is happening to them. All they got to do is you just tell them, this is what these racist white folk who've left the city, this is what they're doing for you. All they need is a leader. All folks need today is a leader to communicate to them their misery. And that's what communication is all about. Communication, good communication, is expressing people's feeling, and you express that feeling in the term you want to express it. So if that is expressed in a racist, negative way, we could have violence within our community. That's what I'm afraid of. Because in my community where I live, in our welfare office, they have to have guards all over that place. I mean, those women, you're not going to take my check away from me. This is my check. I mean, it's a serious situation. So that's just my prediction. Don't take that. I didn't get that out of the Bible.
In your experience, is there a limit to which white folks can be accepted in the black community? I'll give you two examples in my experience. I tutor down at Third Street Church on Tuesday nights and work with the kids a lot on weekends and take them on trips and things. And they're all black kids. And the woman who runs the chair, she's white and I'm white. We had a little seminar on sex the other night, and a guy who I was working with, a black guy, who works with the kids sometimes, but not as much as I do, was speaking on sex, and I was speaking on sex, which is sort of co-in charge of it. And to be quite honest, I was very jealous of him because he was accepted so much better than I was, and I was the one who puts time in with the kids time and time again. And then in another situation, I know a girl over in Southeast who we've got a good friendship. We've had a good friendship for 4 or 5 years. And yet when I come over to her house, she talks to me very differently, very formally. She talks to her family and to her friends very informally, to me very formally. And it seems as though there's a limit. Do you think that there's truth to that, or do you think that it's something that I just need to get beyond?
I think you need to get beyond it. I really believe that real authentic love can break those barriers. I really believe that. You know, we're in a very racial, culture driven society. But I think real love can go beyond that. Now keep in mind now, the Jewish people had divided the world up between us and them, Jews and the Gentiles. And keep in mind that those first apostles were all Jews. And they expected to go out and evangelize the world. I think that we keep in mind now, we said reconciliation is God's supernatural miracle. So we got to go out with a deep sense of trust and depending on God to develop these kind of relationships in our society. And I think that I think if you give in to racism and bigotry, I think if you give in to it, then you're going to always live with that limitation. If I would have thought that I wouldn't have been able to communicate to white folks adequate this evening, I wouldn't have come. But I suspected it would be more white folks here than it was black folks. I didn't come with any limitation. I came with the idea that I want to communicate to anyone who was here. I came with the idea that God could help to make me accepted sufficiently so I could communicate the truth that you want to communicate. You understand? So I think that I think there is a white deep guilt because you guys made this mess. Now I gotta take responsibility for it, and that's part of my responsibility. If I'm gonna get out of it, I gotta take responsibility for it. White folks didn't get me out of this racist bigot thing. You understand? I had to take some responsibility for it. But you mess it up. You mess it up. And white folks still today don't want to take full responsibility. They'll come up with so quickly, they'll say, reverse discrimination. And then I sound like that's worse than the first. I mean, the first was worse than the second. Because the first got us into this mess. You understand? So that white people have got to take some responsibility. And so I think that's what we work with. We work with the idea that we made this mess so bad. And then we don't quite, believe that the people with the problem down there is as human as us. We don't quite believe that. We think that there's a little something. We sort of believe a little bit in that ham curse. We believe a little bit in it. You understand? And so we don't approach people with high dignity. High dignity in society. No, I think we got to learn how to do it. I think we are damning. We are racist. We all are racist. And I hear white folks all the time today. They so gunshot. You listen to that? I don't think I'm a racist. I haven't overcome it yet. I want you to know you haven't either. It's so much, it's embedded in all of our behavior, in our culture. We need God day by day, moment by moment, to carry us through in this society. It's damaged, it's tainted by bigotry and racism. And that's why it's so urgent that we, the church, begin to live out some reality, begin to show to the world another way, and that we can't just keep giving into it. I don't give into it. I mean, black folks today, you can't hardly discipline a black person because you say the same thing, all you want to say, I'm a racist, and white folks going, fall off. Because they don't want to be no racist. Well, why don't you say, yes, I think I'm sort of a racist, but I really want to be like Jesus if I can, as much as I can, and I need Jesus. I'm doing the best I can. White folks going to have to start confronting black folk. In my organization, in Valk and today, I would not allow, black folks, whenever I try to get them to be excellent, they would say, you're trying to be like white folk. And then you're going to do something good. I said, you're not going to pull that junk on me. I mean, you got to be good at it. You understand? So we can use racism in these negative ways. So we all don't be just like you're an alcoholic. See, an alcoholic don't walk around and say, I have overcome alcoholism. Just say, I'm a recovering alcoholic. And we all are recovering racists. All of us. Ain't not. The person who says he's not racist, I wouldn't give you a nickel for that person. Whether he's black or white. You get him off to himself. Read my daughter's article that's coming in this magazine. It's coming up in Urban Family in the next edition. It'll be dropped this week. It's just being dropped. She's talking about her own life. And she's talking about how she has to constantly deal with that. Deal with that. And how does she actually need white people in her life to help her. To help her. And here's a girl, here's a lawyer and all of that stuff. And say, I need people, I need white folks in my life to deal with my racism and my bigotry, in life. And so we need each other. In this society, we need each other so bad. That's why we need churches that are reconciled churches. So we become more human. We become more human. I look at the children, the white children who grew up in our ministry. I look at the black children who grew up in our ministry. I see those people as being so much more human than me. I see them being so much more human than the race that the people went on before. They love people on the basis of people being people. You understand? And it's hard for us to do that. We got these hurts. We got all this. And somebody already told us something wrong with them black folks. And somebody told us we don't never trust no white folks, don't ever tell them everything. And so we act out of all of that kind of a fear. Yes. No, I think that's what I was saying. I was saying that our society is so racist and so bigotry on both sides. I think though that what we got to do is that we have got to form congregations in our lifetime where we overcome that, where we accept. You see, I think again that we see conflict as being unhealthy. We see suffering as being unhealthy. So we are forever looking for a smoothness. And if you're going to see racial reconciliation, we got to accept conflict as a part of what it means to be reconciled, to be healed, to be healed. You're just, to me, saying how damaged we are in America. That's all you're saying. Because the Bible is saying one thing, and we are forever shaping the culture and are forever giving in. Forever giving in to it. Now I'm talking about black and white. Black and white. I'm not talking about one being better. You see, I think that's what makes white folks gun shy again, is that we blacks make them feel over guilty. Because you are guilty. But we magnify. You understand? We magnify to it almost then, we almost become hateful. And we don't then try to be healing. Try to be healing. We need to be healing within this situation. Yes?
Yes, in terms of reconciliation between black people and white people, and is it better to gloss over the differences and to say, well, we're all one in Christ?
No, I think...
Or is it better to recognize that there are differences and to learn from each other?
I think that's the better one, last one. You need to learn from and somewhat... magnify the difference in a healthy way. There's several books you might need to read. One of them is called More Than Equals, written by Spencer. Do we have any out there? I don't tell you, More Than Equals. There's another one that's a good book. It's written by Raleigh Washington and Glenn Cairine. My More Than Equals is written by my son Spencer and Chris Ross, White and the Black. And they talk about that. You got to be intentional. You got to come back and believe that the Bible calls to be. See, right now, the church, black congregation, not the white congregation, believes, really, that God calls to be reconciled. That we can have a church without being reconciled. We can have a church without the gospel, God's love, being displayed. We can have that. So we don't believe that it's God's mandate that we love each other. We don't believe that. We don't believe that. If we believe that, then we would begin to form churches that based on that. And so when it gets tough now, we say that I don't have to put up with this stuff. I don't have to put up with these white folks. These white folks say, I don't have to put up with that. That culture is too different. I don't have to come up with it. And so we yield to it. And then we have what we got. But it's not healing. It's not healing. The gospel can't deal with reconciliation, and that's the purpose of it. Whenever the Apostle Paul, listen to this, challenge you. Read the Bible. Every time the Apostle Paul uses the word gospel and its power, he mentioned it in relationship to race. the miracle of the gospel was that Jews and Gentiles was being reconciled together in one body. Paul is saying to the Gentiles that you was alienated outside of the commonwealth of Israel, without hope, without God in the world, but now in Christ, you've been reconciled. Now, you won't hear none of the radio ministers saying that. You won't hear Swindoll, MacArthur, and all. They'll talk about reconciliation to God, but they will not talk about reconciliation across racial lines. Stanley and all those folks, you will not hear that. You are here talking nicely about religion and about Jesus in a nice way, but you will never hear that the gospel is God's supernatural power to reconcile alienated people to God and each other. We have formed a religion based on our racist culture, and we are satisfied with it, and we are satisfied with our churches growing in that direction, and we're going to lose a nation. We're going to lose a nation. Yes.
A lot of this to do with sort of like heresy we call introduced that says amongst all evangelicals that, you know, Christian discipleship or Christian way of life is to figure out what are some of these moral niceties rather than the demand to imitate Jesus, which was if we accept the gift that God came into our world and we freely accept that, then that must compel us to move into each other's world to imitate that. And that seems to be a far stronger tie to our essential Christianity than just looking at reconciliation as you talk about. Is it one of 25 to 30 things that might be nice to do whenever we find time to do it?
Right. You're absolutely right. And you see, right now, we done played out the homogeneous thing, right? We done played that out. The churches are white and black. And the churches are in suburbia growing fast. White and black. Now we want them to grow faster. And so we're going to Korea. And we are looking at you and others. Those ain't no Japanese in no churches. Those ain't no Korean reaching out to no Japanese. So we're on another one of these homogeneous trips. So they're praying all night over there. They're praying for the Korean. They ain't praying a bit for no Japanese. You know, and we then fall into that kind of trap. Church growth is more important than the church dealing with the big problem. The problem in our world today are racial. The problem in Yugoslavia today is racial. The problem in South Africa today is racial. The problem in Washington, D.C. is racial. And we have a wonderful, loving Savior who came into the world to reconcile people back to God and to each other, and that the world might know that we are Christians because of that oneness. As He and the Father is one, He calls us to be one in one body, in one church down here on earth. We don't believe that. We don't believe that. We're not serious about that. What I said about, we can build churches without that. We can build churches without reconciliation. Just get the people together just alike. And I mean, it disturbs us to mess with this racial stuff. It's slow up our growth. Yes.
Would you agree that
I have some stories I can tell, but I have some good feelings to watch what you're saying. I think that we are over-concentrating. We're over-concentrating on our kind. We're over-concentrating on our kind. I think you got something. But I can't eliminate the idea that we're to assemble together. You know, we're to assemble together, we're to admonish each other, we're to learn from each other, we're to be equipped by the body. So the assembling is important. And there's some people, there's some congregations that are beginning today to put de-emphasis on going out, putting all of that money into building. And there are some congregations are going out renting buildings. And some people are taking warehouses and turning those warehouses into worship centers instead of putting all that resources just into building. But I think that to put some of the $1 million that people are putting out into building. And I see our country is in trouble. You understand? And I think right now we need to be fervently trying to get a message of God's love and reconciling power out to our society as quick as we can, instead of putting all this emphasis on these buildings. So I feel good about what you're saying. I might not go as extreme as you're going, but I really feel good about you. And if I think if I was around you, I'd want to be with you. Yeah. They're struggling. The question she raised, can I point to any churches where that is, have really become a model? There are churches that are really struggling to do that. Our church in Jackson has always been that way, black and white. But we have to spend time together in worship. You know, like the brother you were saying, we have to plan the worship. And we have to make that a part. We can't sit there and force all of our southern singing on all these northern white folks. You know, so we have to meet together and decide that we're going to mix this together and we're going to respect each other. You know, and you come from that background, we're going to sing some of these songs. We're going to sing some of these songs together. We're going to have a white person to lead the music. We're going to have a black person to read the scripture. We're going to create an environment of us getting to know, and we're going to try to let people see that this is the way the church ought to be. You know, and make people say that this is the way it ought to be. You know what I'm saying? We need to be living like this. We need to be getting to know each other like this. You know, and so I think that's what we have to do. Well, I'm going to quit y'all pretty soon. Go ahead.
I live in the suburbs. What's the practical I can do, you know, to start moving in this direction? As one individual, as a church unit, what can I start doing myself?
First, you're doing the first thing right now is thinking about it and praying about it and seeking to find another friend who is thinking about it, praying about it. I try not to tell people to move into a community in isolation. I try to get them to do it in some kind of a healing way and try to do it with another person. And then I try to get people to, even when they move in, I would say move on a street where there's, I would not encourage you just to move on the street where it was all blacks. I would try to get you to move next door to a white person on this side and a black person on this side. Do you get that idea? I would say that we need to be very intentional with what we're doing. We're going here. We're not going there to be as dangerous as we can be. You know, so I would tell you it needs prayer. It needs consideration. But I think the Lord will show you. Once we begin to will to do something, then the Lord enters into the picture. And we will to do what we consider to be the will of God, then God will meet us there. God will meet us there and help us.
How does a suburban church act in relationship to an urban body?
Right. I think they need to act in terms of some kind of partnership. I think if you got a congregation, I think that we need to be looking for congregations in the city, because you need a church everywhere. You need a church everywhere. You need a congregation everywhere. Now we're talking about in the urban community tonight, we're talking about mission. And I'm answering your question tonight is mission. And I'm saying the urban community is a place where mission needs to take place. So now I'm saying one of the things you need to do is that you need to preach in your pulpit and talk about the need for mission. Open it up so that people can hear the call of God. Then you need to find some people who are living in the city, like Bob and others who are living in the city. Find a congregation there that is doing something and begin to partner up with them. Begin to help them. Begin to do things together and begin to do significant things together in the community. People are saying things like today, you hear them say, well, people just don't need money. Well, they need money too. the biblical idea is that where your treasures are, there will your heart be also. And see, people are using even mission in a negative. People don't want you to write a check. I don't know about that. I don't know about that. Because once I write it, you know the people who become my best friend and the people who do the most for us and the people who have the greatest impact in our ministry is the people who've given us the most. You know what I'm saying? Because they have put their treasures with us and their heart has come to us. You know what I'm saying? Where your treasures are, there will your heart be also. So they go together and they're not one another. They're both. You know what I tell churches? I said, now how to make friends to I got a church in suburbia and I want to make a relationship with an urban church. I find me a little struggling church in the urban. Find that they got some leadership. That's the key. The key is that it has to be leadership. You don't throw your money. If I won't put nothing in if there's not some basic leadership. Because that's just an exercise of nothing. God is a leadership God. You understand? He's starting leaders. So if you find some leaders there in that community, sit down and talk with the people and find exactly what it is they need. Bad. The felt need. Let's say they say we need a van. And they said if we had a van, we could carry these kids camping, we could get them out of the city, we could do this kind of thing, we could transport this choir to sing, you know, young folks' dignity can be affirmed, you understand? Okay, but they don't have a van. I'd go back to my suburban church, and I would gather together the people there, and I would take us for 4 or 5 months, and I would raise $6,000-$7,000. And then I would take that $6,000 or $7,000, wouldn't tell them nothing, wouldn't let them know I was raising it. You know, but I won't make sure they still haven't got a van in between time, you know. And what I would do then is I would take that check, that $6,000 check, write it out in the name of the church to buy the van. I would get me the smallest envelope I could find and fold that check up in it and write just one little note that this is for your van. Nothing else. You know what you're going to do? You're going to find that these people are going to fall in love with you. You gave that to them. And you're going to develop a relationship. That'll be a beginning. And then they're going to come and talk to you. And you're going to say, what else could we do? And they're going to say, well, you know what? We sure need some people to help us tutor. We sure need some people for this camping program we have. We said, well, could you send us some people to help us with the camping program? It'll come out of the relationship. Y'all, I'm going to quit now after this one.
What you were just saying leads to the next question. Are we saying that the ideal is to have churches where it's intermingled, but we'll settle for churches in the suburbs that sort of adopt churches?
Oh, yes. The churches are already homogeneous, so we ain't going to curse them. We're not going to put them out of existence. So what we're going to do now is come up with a way of beginning to solve the problem. If what we call racism, if the root of it is prejudice, if the root of racism is prejudice, and that's what they tell me, and prejudice then, the root of prejudice is to prejudge before you know. And so the only way we're going to solve that problem is begin to know each other and begin to bring those contacts together. That was the outline I'm just giving here. You begin that relationship and then you got to believe that the healing can take place. That's another way. I've already challenged you with that. You got to believe that we can begin this process of healing. I came down here, y'all know Third Street Church, and I thought Third Street Church and National Presbyterian Church, when Louis Evan and Colleen was here, I thought it was some remarkable things happening there.
Still is.
Yeah. But I thought it was remarkable stuff. And here you have a inner city church here, and here you have a church where a lot of riches go, but the relationship was the thing. And I think that's the key. Okay, folks, I'm gonna turn this. Oh, I got another question here. Can't stop this.
I'd like to know if Brother Kane
Yes. Yeah, I got at Mendenhall, I felt that my time was up. I always wanted to get out of there. From the day I got there, and so I was looking for any little chance to get out. But Dolphus and Otis had come back, and the day was now in the church. And here I am, a third grade dropout. And here are these guys, and I went and got their master's degrees in theology. And they can preach much better than I can do that. So I'm now got to go back and find me some people who don't know much. and so I go to me another village up there. Now, I work was in Mississippi, 90%, 95% almost at one point, until we went to New Hebron, until y'all went to New Hebron, Val, the only white people we had was import white people. But now in Mississippi, we have white folks from Mississippi that join our church, that's a part of it. I would say in the church in Mendenhall, you would have it's predominantly black, but you have white people there. In Jackson, it would be about half and half. And in California, it don't. Well, we live in California. It don't really matter. We got blacks and whites there. I mean, by the time we got to California, we have made reconciliation a requirement. Right now it's a requirement. You know, it wasn't no requirement in Mississippi. It was a hope and a prayer and a pleading, but now it's a requirement. I make white folks, they didn't come to my church in California, I'd make them feel like they were bigots. I'd make them feel showing up guilty. No, in California, it's much different. Right now, I could be on any staff or any church in California. And all the churches I wish they could find, white churches I wish they could find black people, you know, who would come on their staff. I mean, when I say staff, that's a high that just wishing them. That's what I'm saying. So California is no big problem. All the way in the back. Okay. Somebody got a hand back there? Yeah. Well, now you said we're nothing but teenagers and children. That's a good thing you're saying that. Children, this is a fact. Children can have more impact on their parents than anyone else. Anyone else. I came to Christ because my four-year-old son went to some Good News Club. And those Good News Clubs, his little life was so changed. And he came back home and invited his father to go to Sunday school. It was because of my son that I went to Sunday school, and it was there I heard that Jesus loved me and gave his life for me. And it came back. Now, I say that one thing. Young in the 60s and even in the 70s, when white young folk would come from California and other places to work with us, and they would come very, very well-to-do young people, and they would come and be living in that poverty down there with us, and they would get so mad with their parents back home. And I would say, don't get mad with your parents. I said, go back home. And they love you. You got an upper hand on your parents. They love you. And you can win them. And I can point you to people now who went back home and won the treasure for Occidental Oil, one of the big companies. That girl came out to live with us. She went back home and won her father to Christ. And he's one of the biggest supporters for World Impact in LA. You know, and